Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Google, eBay, PayPal, once tiny startups, now they are household names, pillars of the economy. They've changed the way we think, interact, do business. Now there's a new generation of internet companies staking claims and drawing huge valuations. Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Zynga, Dropbox. Do they have the right stuff to bring real productive value, that scale of value, or are we in a new dot-com bubble? This hour on Point, big hopes and bubble fears. On the tech front, you can join the conversation. Do you see a bubble or the future, real value and lots of it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in the hour, we'll take a look at Google's big new social networking project, Google Plus, and ask how it stacks up against Facebook. First, to the bubble, or the brilliance, or whatever you want to call it. We'll hear in a moment from a skeptical venture capitalist and a gung-ho Facebook board member. But joining me right now from New York City is Gregory Zuckerman, financial columnist and reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Greg Zuckerman, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here.
I want to get a little flavor with you right here, right now at the top. Mark Andreessen last month was interviewed at the All Things Digital's D9 conference. Of course, he's the 90s Netscape star, now venture capitalist with Andreessen Horowitz. And listen with me, if you would, Greg, to Mark Andreessen here saying, and maybe he protesteth too much and maybe he doesn't, saying no bubble.
A very large number of people think there's a bubble, which makes us think there isn't a bubble. The key characteristic of a bubble is that everybody is convinced that it's not a bubble. And in retrospect, everybody revises their opinions on this, and so everybody's got lots of memories now about all the people in September 99 who said it was a bubble. But I tell you, I was there in September 99, and people were euphoric. And now all I talk to are people who are upset. Generally, if everybody's upset, I think that's a good sign.
Okay, Greg Zuckerman, he's using the word bubble an awful lot there for a time of no bubble, but maybe that means there's no bubble. What's going on? What's got people so edgy on this issue of whether there's a bubble or not, Greg?
Well, there are signs of a bubble, and there are concerns about a bubble, many of them, I would argue. So I guess starting off, you've got LinkedIn, the online network. You get recruiting tools, and you can network online. And that stock went public just recently, more than doubled. First day of trading, the biggest IPO since Google went public in 2004, and it's worth $10 billion now. And the reason for concern is they don't have much in the way of profit. They made about $15 million last year, and they've said they're not going to be profitable in 2011 as they invest in their company. But they're not. It's not just LinkedIn. There are other companies. There's Zynga, which does online games. They filed to go public themselves and raise $1 billion. And they do have more in the way of revenue, but these are online games we're talking about. These are companies that are very young. As you mentioned, Facebook's the biggie. That's coming around the bend. People expect that over the next year or so, and that's going to get a valuation of about $100 billion. And just to give you some comparison, that's more than the valuation that the market gives to Cisco, to Hewlett-Packard, to many household names. And many people are nervous because they remember past companies that people flocked to and invested in and got excited about, like MySpace, which News Corp bought for a lot of money and now almost had to give away recently. Mm-hmm. And Groupon's another one that's got people excited and yet nervous because the daily a company that gives out daily coupons. There's very low barriers to entering these kinds of businesses. And yet there's all this excitement, hence the nervousness.
Social networking seems to lie at the heart of this new era of value creation. We can debate what the value is precisely, but that seems to be the baseline piece here. Not everybody's doing it, but Facebook, the biggest one, and many others, different angles on that. Is that seen as a strong pillar for a new big sort of generational step in internet enterprise?
Yeah, that's the key. That's what's got people excited. And frankly, it's very different. I would agree with Andreessen. It's very different from the last bubble in that there are real revenues here and they're real customers. I mean, LinkedIn, as I mentioned, they've got 100 million members. It's not to say they're all paying members. It's not to say you can get advertising from all those members. But these are real companies bringing real value. It's not pets.com from several years ago. The concern, though, is this is how it starts. People on Wall Street are talking about this being a Netscape moment. And so it's appropriate that you brought in Andreessen earlier in the segment, meaning that in 1995, Netscape went public, and that was sort of the first of a wave of companies, and that did bring real value. And you had companies like Webvan and Amazon.com right after that, and it paved the way for those kind of companies. But then you had that wave afterwards of companies with just business plans and not much real value. And we're concerned. Listen, we've just lived through the housing bubble, and before that, the tech bubble. You could argue that we've had other kinds of bubble, like oil at $140 a barrel just a few years ago. So we're on lookout, red alert for the next bubble, because we've been burnt, and as an economy, it's really cost us.
What does it matter to the larger economy? I mean, we're reading these stories out of Silicon Valley about real estate, you know, going through the roof out there, people competing to hire when there's 9.2% unemployment across the country, you know, fancy cars back in the streets after the years of sort of Death Valley drought after the dot-com bust in 99, 2000. What does it mean for the rest of the national economy, whether this is a bubble or not? Is this just a kind of Silicon Valley and other tech center issue, or does it have broader economic implications, Greg?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, initially, you don't really worry too much about these kind of bubbles. Often, real companies are created from them. As I mentioned, Amazon. Many of us use that and depend on Amazon today, and that came from the last bubble and other kind of companies that we rely on as well. So there's some good that comes from these kind of episodes of excessive investment in certain sectors. The problem is when it goes too far and this misallocation of resources for our society, and obviously, in the housing bubble, early on, people were becoming a little wealthier and it helped them, and their home was worth a little bit more. And then it led to excessive investment in condos in Las Vegas and in Florida, people quitting jobs to go into real estate, to become real estate investors. And it was a real misallocation of resources and capital in our society. And it led to this – first was the boom and then the bust that we're still recovering from. So you don't want to let things get too far, and that's the concern. And right now, you know, it's not just Silicon Valley that's getting excited about these investments like Zynga and LinkedIn. They're individual investors. They're starting to buy these shares. And I talk to people all over Wall Street, and some very savvy. They're dying to get into the next hot one, something called Dropbox people are talking about, which is where you store online photos and such. And there are a lot of competitors for Dropbox, and yet it's going to get a $3 billion or so valuation, people are telling me.
Let's hear from somebody who's been in the thick of this and remains right there. Gregory Zuckerman with The Wall Street Journal. Please stand by in New York. Joining me now from Culver City, California, is Mark Suster, venture capital investment partner with GRP Partners, a serial Silicon Valley entrepreneur himself. He writes the well-followed tech and venture capitalist industry blog, Both Sides of the Table. Mark Suster, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
You heard Mark Andreessen there in our tape at the top of the hour saying, no bubble, not here, this isn't it. You're not so sure. What's your view of what's going on in this realm, Mark?
Well, let me say it this way. It's sort of a mixed story. We clearly are not yet at a broad-based bubble that is impacting retail investors in the public stock market. And that's what we saw in the late 90s. And therefore, it affected many more people.
Everybody jumped in the pool. Everybody got burned.
Exactly. And a lot of people got burned with retirement savings and pension money, and people got euphoric. And a lot of young people lost most of their money. But I would say people don't even agree what the definition of a bubble is. Let me give you a definition. My definition is when people are willing to pay values for an asset that greatly exceed today's intrinsic value of that asset. And by that definition, I would say there are parts of the market that are certainly in a bubble.
So do some surgical separation for us here. Where do you see bubble evidence and where do you see real value?
So there are really two places where I see the potential for bubbles to be forming. One is in the pre-IPO companies, companies that are not yet public. And, you know, earlier we heard Greg mention some of these at places like Dropbox. Some of the more recent ones, places like Airbnb raised money at a reported $1.1 billion valuation.
On $15 million in revenue with Airbnb. Not much for a billion-dollar valuation.
Exactly. And there's a comp. Comps, comparables, are what we look at. HomeAway is a publicly traded company now. They did $152 million in 2010 revenues, and their market valuation is $3.3 billion.
And describe, HomeAway is sort of like Airbnb. They've got they let you book a room in somebody else's house as opposed to a hotel, sort of turn the whole world into a B&B.
So it's they're very similar companies in the sense what HomeAway allows you to do is to book a vacation home by the week. And they're often in resort areas. And that's been a very successful company. What Airbnb does is allow you to book a single night. And that single night might either be in somebody else's house, so you're actually sharing their house with them, or you might be able to take over their entire house. It depends property by property. But they're very similar companies. And they're both very good and successful companies. The question I have is $1.1 billion the appropriate value relative to today's performance?
And I guess a bigger question for people who may be very far from the investment front here is, you know, are these the foundations of a new century's American economy, online booking of a room in somebody else's house somewhere? I mean, is this the stuff that finds the new footing for us to shove off into a new 21st century, Mark?
In technology, we speak about things called disruptive technologies, meaning they change the way markets work. And I want to give you some examples. It is clear to me that Airbnb has the potential to change the way hotels work in the country because you're introducing totally new competition and new revenue streams in the way, let's say, Craigslist changed the way that newspapers work. I'll give you one other example. It's called Uber. Uber is a way that you can book sedan-like services in urban environments that compete with today's taxi market, and it's done in a very technical way. And so when you have the introduction of new companies that can disrupt existing markets, people get excited about how big that can become.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the debate over whether there is a new bubble in the value put on high-flying internet firms in Silicon Valley and beyond, whether we're partying again like it's 1999. Gregory Zuckerman joins us from New York, a financial columnist and reporter there for The Wall Street Journal. Joining us from Culver City, California, Mark Suster is with us, serial entrepreneur, angel investor, venture capital investor. His blog is Both Sides of the Table. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Facebook board member and early investor Peter Thiel. And we've got online response all over the place here. Zing says, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Looking back, I guess, to the dot-com bubble and burst. Richard says, enough time seems to have passed since 2000 so that many think this situation is different. But this tech bubble is sitting inside a much bigger bubble of greed, lack of learning, more greed. Skepticism right there. But let's look to the old-fashioned telephone. John in Rochester, New York. You're on the air, John. What do you see?
Hi. No, I don't at all. In this, I'm a crafts.
Yeah.
Used to sell and accepting credit cards for years and ran across.
John's breaking up on us, but I can see right here Greg Zuckerman. He says he's a craftsman. He does not see a bubble. He uses Square, you know, for MasterCard sale, for credit card sales, the little thing you click into your cell phone. You can swipe the credit card right there, out doing your craftsman work out in the world, Greg. And our caller John says, no bubble, that's real value.
Right. There's a distinction between real companies that have customers and that will continue in hiring jobs and will contribute to society. The distinction between that and people paying way too much for slices, for pieces, for shares of those companies. And I would argue that's what's happening now. Perhaps people are paying too much to get a piece of companies that will change the country and the way commerce goes forward. Also, I think it's really important to remember that there are just few shares available for a lot of these companies, hence the excitement. So I would argue that's why the last tech bubble finally burst in 2000, because finally you had what we call secondary shares, more shares offered out there so that it wasn't a premium. You didn't have to fight to get your hands on them. And also short sellers, people that bet against stocks, could finally roll up their sleeves and get going and bet against these companies. Similarly, today, there are very few shares of LinkedIn, about 10% of the companies available for public trading. And that's much less than even Google Google when it went public just a few years ago. So hence the excitement. There are relatively few of these shares out there. So short sellers can't bet against them, and people are kind of fighting to get their hands on them.
So you can have real value and still have a real bubble if you've got the ratios wrong. Greg Standby in New York and Mark Suster in Culver City joining us right now from San Francisco, California. Venture capitalist Peter Thiel. He was an early investment, $500,000 in Facebook. You can find him if you know the story in the movie The Social Network. He's now president of the hedge fund Clarium Capital, managing partner with the investment firm The Founders Fund, sits on the board at Facebook. He was also a co-founder of PayPal. That paid out pretty well. Peter Thiel, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the program.
You're not buying the bubble argument. How do you see the world here, Peter?
Well, I think that the valuations are fair. I don't think they are by any means cheap. But I don't think you can have a bubble if you do not have the public involved. And very different from the 1990s, there have been no IPOs. Now, I think some people say that there's a sort of a secondary market and people are bidding these shares up on a private company basis. I'm not sure that's quite enough to get you to a bubble. To take LinkedIn as the most recent example, it's currently valued at $9 billion. It went public at a $5 billion valuation. Sort of 2 months before the IPO, the secondary private market was around $2.5 billion. And so even though that seemed expensive and there seemed to be a lot of intensity around people trying to acquire shares in LinkedIn, it was still far below the public valuation. And LinkedIn is one of the very few that has actually gone public. There are a few more in the pipeline, but I think it's very different from the 90s in that there are there have been so few IPOs and the public is not involved. Now,
Peter, may I ask you on just that front? I want to look at the larger picture, but on just that front, here's Facebook. You know, it's been, you know, this putative value of $70 billion, then 80, then 86, and now today, Gregory, Mark are saying $100 billion. To get that kind of valuation, presumably you will need the public to come in here. It's part of the reason we're doing the show today. They're looking at an IPO coming up before too long. I mean, I guess you've got a giant interest in that, maybe $1 billion worth of Facebook you're sitting on. But you know, for that to come true, you're going to have the public in, aren't you?
Well, I think that I can't comment on the Facebook IPO beyond that. We said we probably would go public at some point in the future. We've hit the shareholder numbers where this becomes an issue.
Well, then let's broaden it, because I understand you have some constraints as a board member. But for companies in this generation to achieve that kind of valuation, $100 billion, that's going to require big public participation, won't it?
Well, if you're already at $70 billion, it's not that far to get to $100. I don't think Facebook is undervalued. I don't think it's massively overvalued. My sense is that the valuations are roughly correct, and it's risky. It could go up a lot. It could go down a lot. It's a high-growth company, and the fundamental judgment call people have to make on all these businesses is that they will grow a lot and that they will be around for a very long time, which if both of those are true, they're good investments. If they are not true, they're bad investments. And so MySpace was, acquired for something like $590 million in 2005. It looked like a good acquisition. It grew very quickly, and then it sort of faded. And that's the very big risk with these businesses. They do not they don't grow enough, but then even more important, that they don't last. And so investing in Facebook or LinkedIn or Airbnb or any of these is fundamentally you're making a bet about what the world is going to be like in 2025, and you're saying that it will still be Facebook and LinkedIn and Airbnb, because that's when you make the money, will be in the 2020s, 2030s in terms of profits, dividend streams, things of that sort. Now, what I would say is I want to flip this bubble argument around and suggest that, what does it mean if there is no bubble and these things are right? And I think it means that we have sort of a limited number of very valuable companies that are being created. It's sort of a shockingly small list when you really reflect on it. There are five or six high-profile companies people talk about all the time. You mentioned most of them on the program. It's probably also Groupon and
Living
and,
Social.
And one or two others. But that's about it. And I think these companies are going to be franchised. They'll be around for a long time. I don't see that much innovation going on. And I think the really big challenge the U.S. has is that we don't have nearly enough things like this. And so the debate always gets framed as a question of specific success or specific failure. Is Twitter overvalued at $8 billion or whatever the current valuation is? Or is it going to be a valuable business? Or is it both a viable business and overvalued per Zuckerberg's comments? And there are sort of all sorts of complex debates about the specifics. But the general question is, how do you actually get, is having a business with, is something like Twitter going to actually be enough to give us 3% GDP growth for the next 20 years, which is what you need for the U.S. Economy to recover, for us to meet our escalating pension fund obligations and our runaway welfare state? And I think the answer to that is probably not, or at least that you need a whole bunch of companies like that for that to happen, and we have far too few.
So let's flip it around for a moment, if we may. Mark Suster, I don't know if it's exactly a polarity here, but Peter Thiel wants to look at it the other way and say it's not a bubble, it's a, I don't know, a sparse forest. We need a whole lot more of these coming up, not to worry about them, but to make more, to find the engines of growth that will get us up off the floor of 2% or maybe worse soon, people are fearing, and, you know, get this economy into gear. What about that argument, Mark, that we've actually got too few of these? We need more of this style of young, high-value company, innovative company.
Well, there's a lot of truth to what Peter's saying. Number one, there is limited supply of interesting post-IPO companies that people want to invest in, which is what I think drives up the valuations. One thing I should point out real quickly is that the environment 10 years ago was very different. We had 100 million people online that only connected while they were at the office on dial-up networks. And today, you have billions of users with network effects connecting all the time on mobile devices. So the opportunity is much greater. But I think the innovation and venture capital in our country is going to too limited, too narrow of opportunities. And I think Peter's totally right on that. We need to solve much bigger problems in the country: healthcare, education, energy. Our fund, for example, funded a company in the healthcare space. If I just take Medicare, Medicare spends about $500 billion a year in the U.S., and they estimate 9% of that, 9% of it, or about $45 billion, is erroneously spent, either fraud or misspent. So this company we invested in, Health Data Insights, helps to recover money for the government to try and narrow down the spending. So people need to invest more in healthcare, in energy, in education, and big initiatives.
Gregory Zuckerman, how do you look at that? I mean, if you look at it that way, maybe these internet high flyers are a kind of distraction, a sort of flashy, you know, Silicon Valley casino for high rollers. We'd be better off if we weren't following these fancy baubles and doing other stuff.
Yeah, I sort of have a mixed view on the question. On the one hand, I think that there's some issue, concern about misallocation and too many of these companies getting funding. And there's a company called Melt that's going to do grilled cheese sandwiches, and they got $15 million recently from one of the top VC funds.
Move over, Krispy Kreme.
Yes. But I write about Wall Street, and frankly, I'd rather there be a bubble in Silicon Valley than a bubble on Wall Street, because you'll get some useful companies out of this Silicon Valley potential bubble, whereas when Wall Street is going bonkers, you have too many people quitting jobs and going to work doing day trading or going to work for hedge funds and private equity firms, and the best and the brightest at our universities go off to work for Wall Street. So, and you don't get that much value out of that. Too many traders doesn't really help too much in too many people in society. But in this regard, if you have too many kind of high-tech companies, social media companies trying to help people and catering to individuals online, that's not the worst thing in the world. It's not as bad as too many hedge funds, I would argue.
At least they're pouring the effort into innovation, not just day trading. Let's go to our callers.
Exactly.
Michael in Beaufort, North Carolina. Michael, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. With all these names flashing around, I have a sense there might be a bubble there. And when you're talking about valuation, I mean, there's basics that I don't hear being discussed, like the old-fashioned P/E ratio and things like barriers to entry. Like when you look at some of these companies and you wonder if it's a hot idea, who says that this company is going to have 100% of the market, which some of these are being valued at? And then the other issue is even I wonder even if Google, I haven't looked at it recently, but even a company like Google that's obviously no one's going to doubt the value and of the franchise. I wonder what the PE is, how much you have to keep growing to justify the money put into them.
Well, Mark Suster, can you pick that up and put it in sort of traditional price-to-earnings ratio terms here? You know, you mentioned LinkedIn with that $10 billion versus just a little $15 million on the other side of the slash. That doesn't look great.
Let me pick up Michael's exact question. So Google's PE is about 20. It's 20.5. They did about $29 billion of revenue in 2010. And I'll just give you some other quick comparisons. Apple's PE is 16.9. Microsoft's is 10.5. Cisco is 12. So really the
story are not outrageous.
They're not outrageous. And the story here is what Peter Thiel said earlier. Investors value growth. And so the idea that LinkedIn, you know, while it's a nascent company, it did $243 million of revenue. The idea is that people believe that it's going to grow at a much faster rate than some of these other companies. I mean, if you look at Apple, for example, Apple grew from 09 to 010 from $43 billion to $65 billion. That is enormous growth for a company that was doing $43 billion in revenue, whereas Google in the same time frame grew from 24 to 29, right? But yet the PE of Apple is 16.9 versus Google at 20.5.
So the numbers fly around, but your bottom line is that you've got if you've got the value, this can work and has worked, and these are not overvalued by that standard. On the other hand, well, you've got LinkedIn.
My belief is that the later stage, more established, the story in investors' minds is, can Apple at $65 billion of revenue continue to grow at the pace it's been growing? And it's clear that the market cap on Apple is $326 billion, and people are talking about it potentially becoming the first ever trillion-dollar company. And I think that kind of holds back potential value. Whereas LinkedIn, the story's not known. The story's not known. Does 243 become a billion, become 5 billion, or do they continue at a slower growth rate? So the, in a way, price to earnings isn't as relevant to an early stage IPO like LinkedIn. I think the PE ratio is something like 2000.
Yeah.
But it's on limited revenue base. And so what people are really betting on is not P to E, but what's called PEG, price to enterprise growth. People are betting that it's going to grow at a much faster rate.
And what about somebody else coming into our caller's question, Peter Thiel, and knocking LinkedIn out of that seat that it's carved out? Or for that matter, Facebook. We've got Google Plus up on the rails.
Well, you have to make a judgment. All of these stocks are you're making a heavy judgment that they are going to be the long-term winners. And if that's not the case, the valuations will go down a lot. I want to say one other thing, though, on this profitability question. If you have a company that's growing at 100, 200% a year, that's growing really fast, the correct strategy is to be taking all of the profits and reinvesting them and expanding the business. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think these companies should be profitable. They should not even be trying to make money. It's like Amazon in the 2000s. They made the right judgment of taking all their profits, reinvesting it, and for six, 7 years, people gave Amazon a very hard time because it was never making any money. But that's how you build a really big franchise over time. You know, the alternative would be for these companies to try to be very profitable and to return money to investors. And the investors, in turn, can't really put money anywhere in this country. You can get T-bills at 0%.
Right.
You can put it into bonds at 2.9%, 10-year bonds. And so given that it doesn't make sense for the companies to give money back to the investors if they're growing this quickly, they should be investing in themselves if there's a way to accelerate the growth even further. And I think Amazon is really the template for a lot of these companies. And they're choosing to stay private for longer than Amazon did, because the public markets tend to be really brutal on companies that are not profitable. And people think Amazon did well, but they don't want to follow Jeff Bezos's example of being having eggs thrown at him for 5 or 6 years.
All right, Peter Thiel, stand by. We've got to take a break right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the debate over whether there is a new bubble in the value put on high-flying internet firms in Silicon Valley and beyond. In a few minutes, we're going to look at Google's new social networking offering, Google Plus, and how it stacks up with Facebook. But we've got a lot on our plate right here. Greg Zuckerman is with us from The Wall Street Journal. Investor blogger Mark Suster is with us. His blog is Both Sides of the Table, joins us from California, as does Peter Thiel from San Francisco. He put $500,000 into Facebook very early on. Now he's one of the handful of people on the board at that company. They're headed for an IPO, put some limits on what he can say, but also interests on the table right there. Here's a Facebook comment right here from listener Mike. Peter says, social media, they make nothing. They develop software that spies on those who use them. Their substance, can you say CB radio? And here's a listener in Alabama. Jonathan says he's 22 years old. He says, these companies are not real commodities being bought and sold. I will never pay for social networking. I don't know if you can respond to that one, Peter. I mean, you saw value early on, put $500,000, I guess, of your some of your PayPal money on the table there. But what about skepticism about social networking itself as a foundation for profitable long-term business? Is this just behind-the-curve thinking or not?
Well, I think there are two separate issues. One is whether they're socially valuable, and I think they very much are. People go to college and they make friends before they even start college. The intensity of usage, where Facebook has north of 750 million active users, and something like half of them use it on a daily basis, suggests that it's creating a lot of value for people. And I would submit that it's much better than passive forms of entertainment, like watching some moronic TV show or something like that. So I think I think if you think of it as substituting for television, it represents a big improvement on many different levels.
But you've got a former head research scientist at Facebook, I'm sure you know him, Jeff Hammerbacher, who's left Facebook now, says because he's discouraged. He says, he's quoted here saying, the best minds of my generation are thinking about how to make people click ads. He says, that sucks.
I don't know him. I mean, I think that Facebook is a valuable company. I think it does a lot of social good. I don't disagree that we need to be doing more as a society, and that even though Facebook is a great company, it doesn't mean that we aren't failing because we aren't doing many other very important things. And so I think people are constantly confusing this question of specific success and general failure. Facebook is a specific success. It is a valuable company on many levels, but I think we have a general failure in our society to not create badly needed companies in many other areas.
Let's get on that. More innovation and quick. Sarah in Owensboro, Kentucky. Sarah, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
I'm sorry?
What do you think, Sarah?
I think that the valuations may be reasonable now, but that they're going to go up, and then the public will get involved. And when the public gets involved is when things will head south, when the public starts investing. I think the private investors and the companies will start to cash in on the value of their brands, and the public will be kind of left holding the bag.
That's an interesting observation. Greg Zuckerman, how about it? That certainly has happened before. Mark and Peter talking about how we've got, hedge fund money and what's supposed to be smart money in there now. What about when it gets to the public? I guess the public has done all right with Google, but what about this batch?
Yeah, I mean, Sarah's point, frankly, is the concern on Wall Street that for now, some of these valuations don't look so bad, and some of these are valuable companies. I mean, if you think about Zynga, an online gaming company, they don't have a manufacturing plant. It's a pretty good business to have online games. And frankly, there aren't that many of these companies. As Peter mentioned, there's a handful of these companies, whereas when the last dot-com bubble burst in 2000, there were over 300 of these kind of companies that are public. But the concern is that there's there's more to come, and those that are coming may not be the top quality. And frankly, if you take a step back, I mean, there's a reason why there's a possible bubble here, and the government and the Federal Reserve almost want there to be. With interest rates so low, people are discouraged from keeping their money in the bank, from buying things like money market funds and short-term treasuries, and that leads to speculation. And people are speculating in social media. They're also speculating in things like gold and silver. So there's a reason for that. It's not a very healthy reason, but so far, I would argue that it's a tiny bubble rather than a kind of a big, dangerous bubble.
Mark Sister, what about by the time it gets out to the general public? That worked all right with Google. People who got in at that high opening IPO price did very well indeed. What about with this generation?
Well, the hard thing about Google is that, of course, if you knew a priori that it was going to become what it's going to become, you would have invested. But there were many other companies back then, and it was less clear which ones were going to stand out and which ones weren't. What I would say about Facebook, because I can comment, I'm not an investor and I'm not on the board, and Zynga the same. Facebook and Zynga really do enjoy a barrier to entry, something Michael from North Carolina spoke about earlier, because they have enormous network effects. Once you have a group of people that are all connecting in a similar place, to get people to leave to go to another social network and drag all their friends with them, it's clearly not impossible, but it is very difficult. And so that gives them a certain established base from which to grow. And to Sarah's point about whether, or sorry, not Sarah, the other caller's point about whether or not we're building important enough stuff here, if you look at Facebook and Twitter, in a way, what they're doing is they're giving us the extension of what a telephone system was. And I would argue that the telephone was pretty valuable in that they allow people to communicate with each other that, as we know, has led to democratic revolutions in places like the Middle East. So the ability to communicate, to form groups, to have democracy, political action, I think those are all valuable things. So it's not all games and ads.
Let's flip it around again for a second, Peter Thiel. You've said that if you want to find a bubble, don't look to the new edge here. Look to the old economy, to banks and, heaven forfend, old media companies.
Well, I think that we have this situation where, as Greg was pointing out, we have the Fed printing money like crazy, and it's still not enough to get the rest of the economy restarted. And so, at some point, the problem we seem to be running into is there's some risk that you start getting some kind of inflationary dynamic in commodities and other kinds of things. If that happens, and if they have to start raising interest rates at some point and tightening on the money, that probably hits CapEx-intensive businesses very badly. So it's bad to be like in a shipbuilding business or a car company if oil prices go to $140 a barrel or any of these sorts of businesses, whereas a lot of the computer information technology pieces are fairly low energy intensive, low CapEx intensive, and may actually do okay even when the money gets tightened. So I think there's a question about whether much of the old economy is actually still very overvalued. I think probably housing is still overvalued. I think the banks are still overvalued, and that still is the bubble. We still have a housing bubble, and it seems crazy given how much it's come down. But that's probably the place that I would be inclined to look. And it's bizarre that people think the housing thing is largely over when objectively that's what's still going down, even with massive printing of money by the government. So I think that this whole debate about a handful of tech stocks in Silicon Valley is very displaced and is somewhat symptomatic of how we have our sort of heads in the ground about where the real problems are, the lack of growth in this country, and the way in which that led to unsustainable bubbles and credit that have not fully unwound.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're looking around right now. No head in the sand. Pick your bubble or your value, and good luck to you. Peter Thiel, with the Clarium Capital there, early investor in Facebook, on the Facebook board, joining us today from San Francisco. Mr. Thiel, thank you so much for your time and thoughts today.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Suster at GRP Partners. He writes the blog Both Sides of the Table. Mr. Suster, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
And Gregory Zuckerman at the Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for joining us today, Greg.
Great to be here.
In a moment, Google faces off with Facebook with its rollout of Google Plus. This is On Point. For 750 million people around the world, social networking essentially means Facebook. Now, Google is rolling out its own social networking offering, Google Plus. We want to look at how it is like and unlike Facebook. Joining me now from Palo Alto, California, is senior writer for Wired magazine, Stephen Levy. He spent a year following Google in its work on Google Plus. His new book is In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. Stephen Levy, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So what's Google up to, first of all, with this big effort? Is it trying to supplant Facebook?
Well, it's trying to get in the same game that Facebook's in. Google realized after a number of unsuccessful social networking products that it was a very, very high priority for them to be able to get into the business of having people share information in a way they can get it, because Facebook, as you've been discussing, is mm-hmm. this huge network where people share very important information with it, what their interests are, who their friends are. And Google's mission is to get all the world's information and organize it and make it accessible. And this was very important information that Google's executives came to realize was the biggest gap they've had in their entire 12-year history, that they haven't been able to get that kind of information. And they felt that if they didn't get it, Facebook might corner the market on it. So they wound up to do the biggest initiative in the company's history that touches all their products to make Google more social.
I hope we come back to the strategic picture here, but take us right into the product itself. It's still sort of one of these invitation-only things, which isn't that exclusive. But then, if we go to Google Plus and we're experienced Facebook users, what's going to be familiar, what's going to be unfamiliar, Stephen?
Well, some things will look a lot familiar. There's a thing called the stream, which looks a lot like the Facebook news feed. And then there's a way to organize all your friends and contacts. Google actually has come up with some innovation in this aspect. It's called Circles. And it's a way where you could share information with only people you want to share with. At Facebook, unless you do a lot of tweaking and turning the knobs, when you share something on Facebook, generally it goes out to all your, quote, friends. And this
right.
might include your closest friends, your family members, but also someone you met at a conference 2 years ago who just friended you on Facebook, and you just said you clicked yes, then. And that person now is like a barnacle in your social life.
So walk us through some of the features on Google Plus. If this is Google's social networking utility, what's it look like? What's it got?
Well, it's got some other things. It's got one thing called a Hangout, where you could basically advertise your availability. You say, hey, I'm available to hang out with anyone in some of these circles, and people can jump on there and basically engage in a group video chat with you with up to 10 people. And interestingly, Facebook, a couple weeks after Google announced this, announced their own video technology. It's got a thing called Sparks, which is a way where it's sort of like a search engine. You say what your interests are, and Google gives you information about that interests, but not the same information you get if you type it into the search engine. It's more current, and Google's looks for things that you might want to share with your friends about your interests there. So, again, Google wants to find out what you're interested in and have you share it with your friends and get that information about you and help you share friends information with your friends.
That leads us, I guess, to the privacy question. Facebook is putting lots of advertisers in touch with people using that information. Some people have not been comfortable with that. What about privacy and Google Plus? How does it compare with Facebook privacy?
Well, the idea of the circles that you could only share with the people you want to share actually is a big plus in terms of privacy. And Google is only now figuring out really where to put the dials on privacy. They tested it extensively within the company, but that was something that they learned when they had a big privacy problem with a previous product called Buzz that doesn't find out, doesn't expose the privacy flaws. So they've labeled what's happening now with Google Plus a field test. And they're basically watching what people do, seeing where people complain, saying, hey, this comment got exposed to people I didn't want to see. So they're making adjustments as they go along now that they've gotten hundreds of thousands of people using the system, maybe even over a million.
Is this an either-or question? Will people either be social networking on Facebook or Google Plus? Can you imagine people who would be on both?
I think you can. I think really what you want is for people to be able to take the information that they want to share with the people in their social circles and their friends, contacts, and family, and not worry about which company has control of that information. If you think of what email used to be, there was a time, believe it or not, where you posted an email and you couldn't send it to someone unless they were in the same system that you were. If you were on CompuServe or Prodigy or AOL, for a while you couldn't send email to people on those other services. And people, you know, realize that wait a minute, this should be, you know, open. If I send an email, I shouldn't have to worry about where the recipient does their computing. And I think we should have the same thing with social information, that if I, you know, post something, I could post it as a tweet, I could post it as a comment on Google Plus, I could post it on Facebook. And you know, right now Facebook is in the catbird seat, but I think what Google wants is to get valuable information on its own to sort of force Facebook to the negotiating table and come up with a system that really is better for users.
Is this a Google move to undercut the Facebook IPO so that, you know, Facebook doesn't become even more loaded with cash that they could come after Google with?
Well, Facebook's loaded with cash. They've managed to circumvent the IPO system and the secondary market, and then they're bringing in some money themselves. You know, Google's been working on this for well over a year, and I don't think it's a question of overtaking Facebook in the IPO. It's just a question of strategically competing in an important area of the Internet.
Google Plus, sitting right there now in its field test in the heart of social networking, which has become the heart of the Internet. Stephen Levy's joined us, a senior writer for Wired Magazine, author of In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. Stephen Levy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.